Good afternoon. I believe you can be heard if you wish.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I do. I do. Jack?
Yeah.
Okay. Because of the 3-week period, and there's very little Zohar. This week there's only 6 verses of Zohar. And the next 2 weeks there's no Zohar. The recommended study is to talk about the temple, to talk about our understanding of the temple, what some of the prophecies are, and just to try and understand the difference between being depressed over the temple and its destruction and being upset about the temple. And the major difference is we should never be unhappy. It's kind of difficult for people to understand because most people say, if I'm not happy, then I'm depressed. And it's kind of like sitting Shiva for someone, a parent who has passed. You're clearly sad, but you're not in a long-term depression. During these 3 weeks, we are sad. We focus on the lack that we feel by not having the temple available to us. But we're not truly depressed about it. We know this is part of the process of our own growth, that we have to let go of our various aspects, various tools. As you grow from one level to another, the tool of a 10-year-old, the schooling of a 10-year-old, the books that he used, the tools that he used do not work for a 20-year-old and certainly don't work for a businessman in their 50s or 60s. We have to let go of of different tools at different ages as we progress past them. So we have progressed past the temple, but it will be returned. And so we're going to be studying on these 5 o'clock classes from a website called azamra.org, www.azamra.org. The rabbi who runs this is a well-known author who has translated many books from the teachings of Rabbi Nachman. And he's one of the well-known, more public rabbis who teach Rabbi Nachman's material. And he has translated a book by the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, called the Mishkine Elyon, which he translates that word as the dwellings of the supreme. But the English book he's titled The Secrets of the Future Temple. And the link is online, all in the English. If you go to the homepage of azamra.org and click on free online books, which is on the left about 2 inches down, you'll be able to see a link to the Secrets of the Future Temple. And that's where I'm reading. Feel free to ask any questions as we go on.
Mm-hmm.
You, son of man, tell the house of Israel about the temple, Let them see the measurements of the plan. Let them know the form of the temple and its structure, all its forms and all its laws. Write it before their eyes, and they will guard all its forms and all its laws and do them. These are two verses from Ezekiel chapter 43. Now, Ezekiel is the only prophet to ever prophesy outside of the land of Israel. There was a there was an assumption that prophecy could not be maintained without the energy force associated with the land of Israel. And that was true up until the destruction of the temple. And because of the calamity, we're talking about the first temple, because of that horror, because of that shock to the system, God in his mercy allowed Ezekiel to have a number of prophecies in the land of Babylon. And primarily the reason behind that was to let the people know that he was still around, that God was still connected to the people, that he had not forsaken the people being us. And some of those prophecies are called the Merkavah. The Merkavah means chariot. And it's a meditative technique that I'll teach in the Sefer Yetzirah class, Bezrat Hashem. But it's described, it's different than the study of the creation and the meditative on the Sefirot. It's a much different meditative technique. Still using the Hebrew letters, still using the connections that we have with the Torah. Ezekiel said to the Holy One, blessed be he, master of the world, we are now in exile, and you tell me to go and inform the Jewish people about the plan of the temple? Write it before their eyes, and they will guard all its forms and all its laws and do them? How can they do them? Lead them until they go out of exile, and then I will tell them. The Holy One, blessed be he, said to Ezekiel, just because my children are in exile does not mean the building of my house should be halted. Studying the plan of the temple in the Torah is as great as actually building it. Go and tell them to make it their business to study the form of the temple, as explained in the Torah, as their reward for the study. As their reward for this study, I will give them credit as if they are actually building the temple. This is a midrash from the Parashat Tzav.
Mm-hmm.
This is an overwhelming. It's very similar to the idea that the sages have said to us, that the prayer that we do three times a day, that prayer, those prayers, are actually the equivalent of the sacrifice in the temple. There's an amazing teaching in this midrash, and in that teaching is it basically that it's saying the action is the illusion. By changing the physical action of a animal sacrifice, of a lighting of incense, to the physical action of studying the action, of thinking about the action, of contemplating the action is the same as doing the action. Now that is very difficult for people to understand and accept. What's more important, the doing or the talking about it. Everybody will answer you that doing is more important. We live in the world of action. And here, we're told they're equivalent. They're the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we understand that? I think the only way to truly understand that is to recognize that God is merciful. Truly, if you have the temple in existence, you must do the action. But because of our actions that caused the temple to be destroyed, God in his mercy says, okay, you can't do these actions because the temple's gone. You've destroyed the temple, but I'm not going to throw you away. I'm not going to make it impossible for you. So on this lower level of connection, where you are today, where you have fallen to, this is a way to get the same benefit. We are told that God judges the Tzaddikim to a hair's breadth, more strictly than other people. And each generation is judged according to its level of consciousness. And each Tzaddik is judged according to where he is at. And all of this is really describing this mercy of Hashem. We make a mistake, we have the consequence, but we're still given the tool that we can use to receive the same benefit. Now, ultimately, it's not the same benefit. We have to understand that. But it is what we have today. The Secrets of the Future Temple is a translation of Mishkanei Elyon by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the Ramchal. It discusses the significance of the design of the Third Temple as prophesied by Ezekiel and explains the purpose of the temple services. This is a serious Kabbalistic text that will be most meaningful to those who have a grasp of the temple layout and services, as well as some familiarity with Kabbalistic concepts. And that's really the purpose. That paragraph is designed to explain why there's these introductory discussions before we actually get to the book itself. I'm going to go to the gate of heaven. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have trouble here because my phone doesn't work. Mm-hmm. My Wi-Fi is working through my phone, and my phone when I'm on the phone, the Wi-Fi doesn't work, so I'm going to need to get off and get to that page, and I'll come back on. In the meantime, I'm going to stop the recording. So I'll be back in 1 or 2 minutes.
Okay. Okay.
Overview, The Gate of Heaven. Rabbi Elazar said, what does Isaiah mean when he says, and many peoples will go and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of God, to the house of the God of Jacob. Why the God of Jacob and not the God of Abraham and Isaac? The answer is not like Abraham, who saw it as a mountain. As it is said, this day on the mountain God is seen. and not like Isaac, for whom it was a field, and Isaac went out to pray in the field, but like Jacob, who called it a house, and he called the name of that place the house of God. The story of the quest for the temple begins with the patriarch Abraham, who changed the entire course of human history by finding God and teaching the world about him. Abraham is an amazing human being. There is no question. One of the understandings of the cycle of history is to read the section of Genesis that leads up to Lech Lecha, the portion where God speaks to Abraham for the first time, and to understand that the first 10 generations from Adam to Noah, each human being in that generation was capable of correcting the whole vessel. Everybody would have been corrected by one person. The tikkun could have been achieved, but it wasn't. We did not finish the job. The next 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, we had families, and every family had the capability of producing a full correction for every human being. But it was starting with Abraham that it was no longer capable of making a correction by such a small group of people. It took a nation to achieve the correction for the world. That's really what the difference between the Jewish nation and the non-Jewish nation is all about. The Jewish nation, as a group, will achieve the correction of the total. Everyone, Jew and non-Jew, will return to the endless world. That has not changed. But who does the work and what is the reward for that work? That's open to discussion as part of the prophecies we have been receiving. Abraham changed the course of human history, but he still could not achieve and finish the correction by himself. He taught the world about God and attracted people to that teaching. And those people ultimately came down to the 12 tribes, and ultimately were forged into a nation in the restrained land of Egypt. According to tradition, Abraham was abandoned in a cave as a tiny baby, but miraculously survived. When at last he crawled out of the cave, it was night. He looked up in wonder at the millions and millions of stars high in the heavens. He said, these must certainly be the most powerful forces of the whole universe. These must be the gods. And when dawn came and the stars disappeared, he said, those little lights can't be gods because something else has outshone them. When the sun rose and shone in all its glory, Abraham said, this is the most powerful force. This is God. But when the sun declined and set, Abraham understood that the sun is also not God. When the moon appeared, Abraham realized that none of them is God. All were created by one supreme God, who alone has dominion over the heavens above and the earth below. It's interesting that this Midrash talks in terms of power, that God is perceived according to power. And yet the Jewish nation is the meekest, the weakest, the least numerous of all of the nations. It's designed that way. Where does power come from? If you cannot be the most powerful, how do you achieve power? It's a rhetorical question, but it's something that's, this is the first, I have read this Midrash many times in many places. The first time that I ever realized it was related to power. Continuing, Abraham devoted his life to seeking out and revealing the unified power that underlies the manifest plurality of creation. Abraham's search for God is expressed not only in the biblical narrative, but also in Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Formation, foundational text of the Kabbalah, which is attributed to him. In it, he presents the 22 letters of the Aleph-Bet as the fundamental coordinates and elements of creation, showing how to combine and manipulate these letters of creation in order to channel beneficial influences through meditation and prayer. That paragraph, as written by Rabbi Avraham Greenbaum, I believe, the author of this translation and the author of this website, which I like his teachings a lot. He is describing the Sefer Yetzirah in a concealed way. He's not really explaining it in forcefully enough, in my opinion. Abraham realized there was one God, one supreme force, who created everything else. And then he wrote a book of outreach, a book of explanation to his generation. Now, who is it? Abraham's generation? It's us. But it's also a historical generation. He wrote this book to the generation and said, here is how you find God. Here is how you learn to know God. Here is how you can experience God on your own. Without me, I can't prove it to you. Here's how you discover it for yourself. That book, which originally is the Sefer Yetzirah, consisted of 400 chapters. It spoke to all people everywhere in how to reach and experience God. Over the course of this generation, over history, over negativity of people, that book came down to Rabbi Akiva in a form that was not usable. Parts of it had been lost, major parts of it. Rabbi Akiva reorganized it. He rewrote it into its present form as we have it now. And even today, we have three different versions. Still, what we've lost is still available, still around. It's not needed. Because those people who needed it have made their correction and are waiting for the rest of us in the Garden of Eden. We need our generation. The people on earth today are the lowest of the low. You want to be proud of us? Believe me, we are far from being proud of. Rabbi Akiva edited what he had available and put it in a format that you and I can utilize to experience God. Yes, Abraham wrote the book. But the academics will tell you that it was Rabbi Akiva, and they're not wrong. Neither side is wrong. All you have to do is crawl up the side of the fish tank to get above it so you can look down upon it to see the true color of the fish. Abraham made his life one of selfless service to God in all he did. His mission was to bring God down to earth by following the path of kindness and justice in practical everyday life. Abraham's vision was of a land whose people serve God in the way they grow and harvest their crops, eat and drink, buy and sell, marry, have children, and go about their other affairs. Is that Abraham's vision? I'll leave that for you to decide. Thus, Abraham received the prophetic call, "Go to the land that I will show you." He had to search until he found the place most fitted for this exalted purpose. Even when he came to the land, he was tested time after time, until at last he received God's command, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as an offering on one of the mountains, which I will tell you." On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. With his prophet's eyes, Abraham knew as soon as he saw it that this was it, the place, at the climax of his lifelong search for the source. Here at Mount Moriah, Abraham finally reached the center point, where the earth connects with the worlds above it. This place is the place of Eben Shtia, the foundation stone, from which the earth emanated like a fetus growing out from its belly. This was the place where Adam was created, and here he sacrificed. Here Noah sacrificed after the flood. It was a fitting place for Abraham to offer up his son Isaac, to elevate him to a life of perfect submission to the will of God. Abraham called the place the mountain where God sees and is seen. I don't understand why the rabbis continue to veil so much material. I don't understand it in our generation. Abraham knew that he was not going to sacrifice his son. And if you read the text of the Akedah, you see it says, "You two stay here and we'll go on and we'll return later. We'll return in 3 days," I believe it says. He knew he wasn't going to sacrifice Isaac. He knew that wasn't the issue. What was the issue? The issue was the relationship between mercy and judgment. Abraham was a chariot for mercy, constant love, expansive love. But love a child like that and give them all that they desire without limitation, and you create a monster. There must be a balance between limitation, judgment, and mercy. That's what Abraham and Isaac represent, and I do not understand why the rabbis don't come and reveal that, as the study of the Kabbalists do. The service to which Isaac was called was that of the heart, prayer, in which we reconnect with our spiritual roots through the use of words, born through combination of the letters of creation. And Isaac went out to pray in the field. Isaac's chosen field, a field of labor was none other than the mountaintop where he came face to face with his destiny. Isaac turned this lofty mountain of self-sacrifice into something more attainable, a field of regular spiritual discipline. Why did Isaac call the mountaintop a field? I really don't know. But I'm going to remind you of some of the things that I've read in the Book of Prophets and in the Zohar, how Isaac represents the soul after correction, after the Mashiach comes. Isaac and Rivka represent the body and the soul after correction. Isaac is the left column. Isaac is the frame of judgment, same frame of power. There will always be a left column. Mashiach does not mean there is no limitation. It just will not be a selfish one. It will be done for the benefit of people. Also, in the prophecies, we have described an earthquake in the land of Israel that levels the land. And maybe that's why Isaac refers to this place as a field, because it will become a field after the Messiah as part of the effect of the War of Armageddon that we hope does not manifest in such a negative way, and that we strive and work towards teaching so that people will come to understand that their consciousness dictates this, and that we can stop that war from manifesting. It was to the same mountain field that Isaac's son Jacob came when he was forced to flee from his brother Esau. As the sun went down, Jacob built a primitive structure where he could lie down and sleep. There he dreamed the dreams of prophecy. There was a ladder set on the ground, and its top reached to the heavens. Angels of God were going up and down on it, and God was standing over him. Jacob awoke from his sleep, and he said, "Indeed, God is in this place. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Jacob recognized this as the place where heaven and earth meet, the spot where angels go up to heaven on the wings of our prayers, and angels come down with blessing and sustenance for the whole world. For Abraham, it was a lofty mountain. For Isaac, it was a field of disciplined labor. Jacob now brought the temple idea within everyone's grasp. Establishing the stone on which he rested his head is the foundation of God's house. Remember, when you read the Torah and the story of Jacob lying down on the stones, in plural, and getting up from the stone, what happened during the night? There's no longer separation on the material world. That is a level of consciousness that we can achieve, that we can reach. How we will do that? Who will be the one who will show us the way? That's the Mashiach. But if we do not think of these things, we will never achieve them. God forbid we never achieve them. The idea of a house can be understood by all as opposed to that of a mountain or field, which are more remote from most people's experience. Only in our generation, go back 300 years, and people didn't live in cities. They lived on farms in the country. They knew mountains, they knew fields. We don't anymore. Just as we dwell in our homes and houses, carrying out our base daily function, so the divine presence may be said to dwell in a house appropriately designed and conducted. The house that Jacob's descendants were to build on this spot would be a sign for all humanity of God's presence in the world. The establishment of this house was the end goal of the journey of destiny on which Jacob now set forth. So the place, Temple Mount, is the center of the earth-heaven interface. And yet God says, build for me a sanctuary and I will come and rest among them, among us. Do you understand the comparative of these two ideas? There is no central point that is the energy center of the earth. And everyone will tell you that I'm wrong. Everyone will tell you that they sense energy in Jerusalem like nowhere else. They sense energy in Israel like nowhere else. And they are correct at their level of consciousness. You want to go to Israel? Build it. Build the sanctuary for God. He rests among us. This is the center point between earth and heaven. As much as we will discuss that the temple will be rebuilt, there is discussion among the Kabbalists that maybe it's only consciousness. Maybe it doesn't have to manifest in a physical way. I don't have the answer. I'm just proposing the question.
Mm-hmm.
Design of the sanctuary. Years after his dream of the ladder, when Jacob went with his children into exile in Egypt, he planted trees. These were to provide the beams his descendants would need to build the sanctuary when they went out of Egypt. This was the temple prototype that they would carry with them in the wilderness and erected all their encampments. That is something I have never read before, and it's just overwhelming me. I won't spend much time on it because I need to think about it. But it truly is an amazing thought that the temple is a tree. A tree that someone planted. A tree that someone intuitively knew, I will need this to create whatever it is I will create. And God said to Moses, tell the children of Israel to take from me an offering and let them make me a sanctuary, and I will dwell in their midst. According to all that I show you, the design of the dwelling place and the design of all its utensils, so shall you make it. The Bible gives a detailed account of the design of the sanctuary and its vessels. The chief craftsman was Bezalel, son of Uri, of the tribe of Judah. The Midrash relates that when Moses saw Bezalel's ready grasp of the design, he said, you must have been in the shadow of God, which is the play on his name, Bezalel. When he showed up the design, and that's how you knew, for the design of the sanctuary corresponds to the underlying scheme of creation. The rabbis thought Bezalel knew how to combine the letters with which heaven and earth were created. that as he understood the different ways in which the supreme lights contained in the letters of creation combined to bring this world into being and sustain all its creations. Correspondingly, he understood how to construct the physical sanctuary in such a way that these lights would shine forth to all the creatures in the world in order to provide them with sustenance and blessing. What is the spiritual law here? There must be a vessel to reveal the fulfillment. What the Creator wants to be revealed about himself, there must be a vessel to reveal it. And that vessel must have affinity with the revelation, with the fulfillment. And that vessel must have a desire to reveal what it will be fulfilled by. Do we have to have a physical building, or is it just related to desire? After the Israelites entered the land of Israel, they set up the sanctuary in Gilgal, and then built a more permanent structure in Shiloh, and subsequently in Nob and Gibeon. The secrets of the design of the sanctuary were handed down from generation to generation until they were entrusted to the prophet Samuel and the messianic King David. Having conquered Jerusalem, David instructed his son Solomon to build the temple. Then David gave to Solomon his son the design of the vestibule and buildings and treasuries and upper rooms and inner chambers and the place of the ark. All this in writing, as God has made me wise with his hand upon me, all the works of this design. Solomon began building the temple in the year 2928. According to the traditional Jewish reckoning, and completed it 7 years later. The design of Solomon's temple is explained in detail in the first book of Kings. Once the temple was built in Jerusalem, it was strictly forbidden for Jews to build a temple or offer sacrifices anywhere else.
And has no idea.
Hello?
I'm here.
Hello? Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
I can. You all right?
Yeah. I'm listening.
Okay. Was that background noise?
I'm sorry?
There's something very strange, some background noise. That's what I was asking about.
Oh, no. I just stepped out for 1 second from my office.
Okay.
Get some air. But I'm listening.
Solomon's temple inaugurated an unprecedented period of grace, prosperity, and cultural flowering. But having been built by human agents, the temple could not last forever. When people abandoned the ideals it embodied, the divine presence departed. For it came to go amidst corruption and evil. After standing 110 years, the first temple was destroyed by the Babylonians in the year 3358. And the Jews went into exile for 70 years. They repented and returned to the land and started building the second temple in the year 3408. It stood for 420 years until its destruction by the Romans in the year 3828. Full details of the design and rituals of the second temple were carefully preserved by the early generations of Tanaim. teachers of the Mishnah, who had actually seen the temple and taken part in its ceremonies. The design of the temple is the subject of the Mishneach tractate Midot. While its rituals are discussed in the other tractates in the order of Kiddushin, and many other places throughout the Talmud. But from the time of its destruction by the Romans, the temple ceased to be a tangible reality in the world, and instead became a distant dream. Jews have prayed daily for the realization of this dream ever since, even under the worst conditions of exile and persecution. I want you to recognize the number 8 at the end of all of those years. It was started to be built in 2928. Destroyed by the Babylonians in 3338. Started to build the second temple in 3408 and destroyed in 3828. Why do each of these years end in 8? There is a essay that I highly recommend that people read. It's very numerically oriented. It's indicating that Rabbi Ashlag indicates in his writings that the next cycle that is open for major change in the world is in the year 5778, or the year 2018. We are not going to live our lives as if that's the end of the world, because it's not. But we will recognize this relationship to the years that end in 8. We will come to understand what that 8 represents, what it's all about. In the 25th Ezekiel's vision, I'm just going to read the vision and then we'll call it an end for today. In the 25th year of our exile, on the new year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was struck, on this very day the hand of God was upon me, and he brought me there. In visions of God, he brought me to the land of Israel. Go ahead. And set me down upon a very high mountain, where there was the likeness of a city to the south. And he brought me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass, with a cord of linen in his hand, and a measuring rod. And he stood in the gates, and the man said to me, Son of man, see with your eyes, and hear with your ears, and set your heart on all that I will show you, for it is in order to show you that you have been brought here. Declare all that you see to the house of Israel. Ezekiel's vision is of the man telling him how to build a temple. It is a different temple than the temple Solomon built. It isn't the same size, but it's relatively the same size, the same relationships. But it is not the same. Just as the generations had the opportunity to complete for everyone, and when they did not succeed, they had the opportunity to complete by a family grouping. And when that did not succeed, there was the need to build a nation. There's much to be learned in this study. There's much to remember about the loss of the temple. What did we lose? The translator, the writer of this essay, Rabbi Abraham Greenbaum, did not express clearly what took place when the first temple existed. He did not describe that the peace of the world, there were no wars. There was only prosperity. People could not convert to be Jewish in his day, just as people will not be able to convert in the days of Mashiach. Why couldn't they? Because the rabbis couldn't know if their desire was sincere or based on wanting to be as wealthy as the people around them. They couldn't know what was sincere because there was so much material wealth that no one lacked. An amazing description. Does anybody have any questions? I will be teaching this every day this week, Monday to Thursday at 5, and Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays at 10 p.m. Los Angeles time. Come join me. Come ask a question.
Okay.
Have a beautiful day.
You too. Thank you so much.